why do you do those kinds of things?
I don't know.
At 1:59 p.m.
Can you just stay here for 1 second?
What the hell is it doing?
I heard everything you said.
You already know my response about that.
What makes me think he's hearing anything I'm saying?
Good.
In trying to understand my son a little better, I've begun reconstructing what I was up to at his age. It's admittedly painful to try to penetrate the purple haze of my prose, but it's true. Maude was certainly someone I'll never forget. When I got to Paris that springtime, so long ago, I brought an old VW camper from a German hippie for $400 and began taking photographs right away.
Welcome to Film Wax Radio, the independent film talk show. Every week, we're visited by filmmakers, actors, journalists, programmers, and others to sit down and chat about the state of independent film. Today, my guest is legendary documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. McElwee broke out on the scene in 1986 with the award-winning Sherman's March. The film was the first of many where McElwee was to explore aspects of his own life and identity as a single man, a married man, a son, a father, a southerner, and a filmmaker. But the films were able to transcend the personal and successfully tap into the universal zeitgeist of the moment. Some half dozen films later, and he brings us his latest photographic memory. The film is McElwee's attempt to better understand his fractured love for his son Adrian. In doing so, the filmmaker travels back to Brittany for the first time in decades, where he retraces his own journey into adulthood. The meditation on the passing of time, the praxis of photography and film, and the digital versus analog divide. I'm so pleased to welcome Ross McElwee to FilmWax Radio.
You might be the singular documentary filmmaker who actually keeps the camera on so much of the time. You probably don't miss a lot.
But I don't. It's just an illusion. I mean, my shooting ratio is actually quite low, and my films give the impression that I can't put the camera down and I'm always filming. But in fact, if that were the case, it would be disastrous in the editing room because I'd accumulate so much footage. And of course, the problem is you've got to edit it down to an hour and a half. So it seems like I'm always filming, but of course you can't see as a viewer the times I'm not filming because obviously it's not being filmed.
Well, first of all, I don't believe you. I believe that you don't film a lot, but I believe your rationale. You say that it's because, you know, the problem would be in the editing room. I believe more. It's because you're filming your friends and family, you would drive them crazy and create so much of a problem.
Yes.
That's probably one of the reasons.
Well, it's the most important consideration.
Sure.
We were talking about it from a technical aspect.
Very true.
What you,
I'm putting you on the spot.
But yes, of course. I mean, the main reason I can't be shooting all the time is that my family and friends would flee every time I came, if that were the case. For every minute of film where you see my son on screen, there are 1,000 minutes when I'm not filming him.
Yeah. I once talked to Doug Block about that very thing after his most recent documentary came out about his daughter. The same sort of experience, which for you both and a couple of other filmmakers, it must be a shared common experience. So while we are talking about your son Adrian, we've seen him grow up in the film, but let's talk about his life being the son of a documentary filmmaker.
Well, I'm sorry that he's not here, because you could ask him yourself. And in fact, he has accompanied me to lots of film festivals and has talked to the press. And you know what he'll say is it's kind of a pain in the ass, but he also, there's a way in which he gets off on it, I think.
Uh-huh.
He likes the attention. And when he was younger, I think it seemed, if I may speak for him, perfectly normal. It's like having your picture taken. It didn't seem that unusual.
That's what he knew. That's the world he knew.
That's the world he knew. And he came to early screenings of my films when he would appear, like in Bright Leaves. He was there for the premiere, the New York Film Festival. And I remember, I just don't think it registered in a way. It was on a huge screen, Alice Tully Hall. There were like 1,000 people there. And there he was, you know, the giant face. But then afterwards, all he talked about was how he really wished he'd brought his skateboard so he could skateboard at Lincoln Center. So I think there's a way in which it both seems real and unreal. And to me, that's also true for my life up on the screen. It seems both unreal and real.
You've been shooting your life for 30-some years, right?
Yes.
You also don't know a different way. What would life have been like had you not picked up the camera? And also because that period of time synchronized with the handheld camera and the technology getting lighter and cheaper and all that, that sort of happened at the same time as your trajectory, your creative trajectory as a filmmaker.
That's true. And it's one of the things I allude to. I don't go into great detail about it, but that my career has now been so long that it does encompass that entire shift from analog to digital. And, you know, I'm getting older, so for me to master these new technologies as they come along is more and more difficult. Whereas for my son, he has no problem at all.
Yeah.
So that is a theme in the film, and, it, you know, it's not a major theme, but it's a definitive theme in the film.
It's what divides you, and also it's what you have in common.
That's
in
right.
a way. You share this creative pursuit in common at the same time.
That's right.
His is, and he grew up in a world of multitasking and
so much imagery. What do they do with all these images? I mean, they take thousands and thousands of stills, and their computers get overwhelmed by the amount of data that it has to store, that they have to store. And
yeah.
that sometimes I ask him, well, do you ever edit, have the time to go through and sort of cull through the photographs you took, like on a trip that we take? And he says, I'm going to. But he gets overwhelmed with the next wave of images and never gets back to the other wave. So I think part of it is learning to come to terms with how easy it is to make images and then putting some, applying some discipline to your work. And he's learning how to do that. I don't know what I'd do if it had been that easy to make images. I mean, those photographic stills that appear in photographic memory, black and white 35mm from black and white 35mm negatives, you just couldn't take that many because cost was one problem, film was expensive, and then also you had to process and print each one separately.
Sure, sure. There was a ton more preparation ahead of time in creating anything with film, the expense and the... just the labor.
Yes, well, I think it's a more difficult medium to work in, and I'm glad that it worked out that I happened to have been trained in film, because I think I've carried over some degree of attentiveness and discipline to shooting HD, and I'm not a terribly disciplined person. I could well imagine that if I'd begun on digital technology, I'd be just like my son. I'd have more footage than I could possibly edit.
So you were glad that you came up when you did, and for that reason?
Well, yes, insofar as you can now always ever be glad that you're as old as you are.
but yeah. Right. Do you, what are your feelings about film? It's such a central conversation right now, the tension between film and digital, or analog and digital.
Well, I don't want to romanticize film. I mean, there are many things that were very difficult about working with it. I could tell you countless stories of discovering I'd ruined a roll of film, or the laboratory had ruined a roll of film, or I couldn't find the money to buy the film that I needed to complete a section of a film. And all of that's changed. Now, if you don't like what you've shot, you just erase it, you delete it. Or, you know, if you need more footage, you just put in a new memory card. I mean, it's just a totally different world. And who could say that that's a bad thing? I certainly don't want to imply that. Plus, the image making itself is... becoming stronger and stronger. But I think, as I say in the film, there's some quality that celluloid has, that chemical film-based images have, which is different than digital.
Having to do with color and texture.
It's color, texture, but it's almost a kind of aura. And it has to do with grain, the movement of grain, as opposed to lines or pixels. And it's just different. It's not better. It's not worse. It's different. And it's a difference that I gravitate towards. And I think...
When you say gravitate, you're talking about digital, I assume.
That I appreciate and mm-hmm. prefer. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I try to shoot digital HD the way that I shot film. And when we do the color correction in post-production, I try to give it more of a film look.
When did you transition from
well, I was
digital?
A late holdout. This is my first film shot in HD.
Is that right? Photographic. Okay, so it's photographic memory. And as we were talking, I was realizing we should catch up with people that are listening. Maybe give a synopsis of the film. You probably could do a better job than me. I was particularly interested in the way you structure your stories, that there are usually multiple threads going on, and they seem to sort of all emerge in telling one story. And I also wonder if how much of that is conscious, or are you just going with sort of intuitively into an experience and you find the story through that?
Well, I think it always begins consciously, as there is a subject that I'm interested in. And with photographic memory, for instance, there were two impeti, that's a word, side by side. One was to try to solve, for me, the psychological problem of feeling distance between my son and me. And I'm not an idiot. I understand that generations are always going to have some conflict and that there will be different, and the younger generation always has different expectations of how their lives should be lived. Of course that's true. And yet, emotionally, I felt a little distraught that I could see my son floundering a bit. This, you know, the footage that's in the film is 3 years old. This is, you know, back then. And I was a little bit concerned about that. But then that led me to think, what was I doing at his age? And that in turn...
Some excesses. He was having some excessive behaviors. Is that what you're referring to?
Some which?
That your son, Adrian, he was practicing excessive behavior at the time.
Yes. Well, I mean, his skiing, I thought, was... his extreme skiing was dangerous, and I certainly didn't approve of the fact that he would smoke pot before he'd ski, and those kinds of things, which, you know, millions of kids do. Of course, I get that. But there's something about the combination of those two things that I thought, this is going to end badly someday. It never did. You know, I was wrong. He could do it. And yet...
We don't condone this behavior, by the way.
Right. So. We have to make a public announcement.
Disclaimer of sorts.
This is a public disclaimer. We do not condone skiing backwards, shooting video while you're stoned. But my son did. My son did not harm himself. So in a sense, my plea is for naught. He knew what he was doing, sort of. I think equal with that strand of exploring the difference between our two generations, there was the trip I took back in time to go back to Brittany in France and try to find people I knew when I had gone there as a young man in my 20s and had gotten a job as a wedding photographer's assistant. And I had not been back to this little village in 38 years and had not had any contact with my employer, who was a photographer, with a young woman I had a romantic relationship with who lived in that village. And I didn't know if I'd find them. And so that was my goal for that part of the film, is to go back and see if they were there.
By the way, we're speaking with Ross McElwee, who has made, is this your eighth or ninth?
I think this is the tenth.
Your tenth film, congratulations. It's called Photographic Memory. It deals with an all-new theme for Ross. He's looking inwardly and at his personal life. It premiered on Friday, October 12th, and it's the word is that the film is doing quite well. For anyone who's seen your films, as I have, there are also threads that go through all of your films. We're brought up to sort of speed, almost like the 7-Up series. I sometimes have that experience with your films, where a few years go by, there's a new Ross McElwee film, and we are reengaged with old friends. And how is that? I guess that was more of a statement, but do you always feel compelled to come back to your life and your family and a couple of friends, or have you wanted just to sort of do, you know, some other project? I'm wondering what goes on in your mind.
Well, I feel that if my films were only about my life, nobody would go see them. I wouldn't go see them. I don't think my life is all that interesting per se. It's what's challenging and what's always reinvigorates me as a documentary filmmaker is to also find other themes in the world at large or in culture or in society or in politics and weave those into the film I'm making. For instance, in Bright Leaves, I wanted to make a film about tobacco, but I didn't want to make an anti-tobacco film. And so my entree into that world was through my family, because I had relatives or ancestors who were very prominent in the tobacco industry in North Carolina. And that gave me the entree into making a film about tobacco So that's an example of finding a larger, broader subject and, in a sense, synthesizing it with my own perspective autobiographically.
So your films deal with identity on the surface. That's, we could put it that way. But if you go deeper, and your identity not only is about, you know, your own personal experience as a filmmaker and a father, but also about the time you grew up in, and also coming, and the South plays a large part of your filmmaking.
Yes,
for sure. In fact, the movie you mentioned, Bright Leaves, also it reminds me of Godfrey Cheshire's film, movie,
yes,
Midway,
movie
explores,
Midway, yes, which is a wonderful film,
isn't it? Is he, yeah, he was a guest here, and actually I have in my film series, which is called Film Wax. We screened it, because I refused just to play new movies, you know. So I sometimes dig from the wonderful trove of films like that, which are.
And if I may ask, what does Film, yeah, Wax mean?
You may. It's one of those things I kind of thought I made it up on the spot in a moment of inspiration, but in fact, it was sort of made up on, about, because I was writing about film at the time, more waxing about film.
Oh,
but really, it's looser than that. That's sort of an answer, but it's really, it was just sounded pleasing to me. It sounded fun in it, not too serious. So, but Godfrey's film, for sure. I have a particular, I guess I share this in common with you, a sort of a nostalgic, a strong nostalgic sort of, you know, bent and obsession, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I think nostalgia is certainly part of this particular film. And of course, as you get older, you have more to be nostalgic about. And so I find myself, right, very much looking at life from that perspective. There's a, mm-hmm, lot of life to look back on, and perhaps not as much to look forward to. So the present has to encompass more and more of the past for me. But I don't want to get weighted down by that, because I think that's not good if you're just always lamenting the fact that time has gone by, and you have to take that fact and then try to generate something interesting with it. And I hope I've done that with photographic memory.
Yeah, and it's also about excavating a little bit, but it's also about figuring out where you are in the world at that particular time.
Yes, that's very true. It's a way.
You're a father. You've been a father for, obviously, you know, maybe 13, 14 years while making the film. But you know, you haven't been You haven't been a father of a 14-year-old or whatever age Adrian was at that particular moment. But you know, so that was still a very sort of new place to be for you.
Yes, that's right. That was a new experience for me. That was my first child, and so that was very fresh. That was very new. But of course, going back to my own childhood or young adulthood was an exercise in actually reaching back into the past and trying to use memory to motivate a film, which I've really never done before. All of my other films are very firmly situated in the present tense. And even though I've used occasional clips from home movies that we use differently, this is something a little new for me to make such a concerted effort to go back into my personal past.
The part where you go back to France, to Brittany, to try to find these connections of yours, there's a nice sort of a mystery. You become a private eye, in a sense.
That's right.
Detective on the scene.
On the trail of my own, yeah, story. So it's like a dog chasing its tail.
Yeah. What was that process like? We see, you know, it take place in probably about maybe a half hour of the film, but how long did that take to kind of...
I was shooting for a whole month. And the nice thing about going to a distant foreign location is that you live in Boston. It's not like shooting in New York where you can just go back and get more footage if you need it. I knew I needed to successfully capture whatever it was, whatever the story was, in 30 days, because that's what my budget, mm-hmm, allowed me in terms of filming. So that having that kind of a constraint on my... time-wise on my shooting was, I think, for me, was a good thing in this case. And I did manage to successfully resolve, without giving too much away, that the stories that I was interested in investigating. So I was able to do it in 30 days.
I don't know of a lot of other filmmakers. I'm sure they existed, but there's probably a couple who made films, personal documentaries. When documentaries were either those industrials... And maybe you actually had to work on those. I don't know, but
I put in my time on industrials.
Everybody
I can
had.
Assure you.
And yes, of course. And then you know, science and history and all. But there weren't a lot of people doing the kind of documentary filmmaking. Certainly have features. I mean,
that's
at the
true.
Time, back in the early 70s? When did you start? In the late 70s?
Yeah, late 70s.
Late 70s. First
film. But in fact, there were a handful of influential people who were experimenting with this new way of making documentary film. One of whom was Ed Pincus, who had a tremendous influence on me and a lot of other filmmakers, especially at MIT, where the graduate program was. And another person, Jeff Krinus, who he's not as well known as Ed, but also did some remarkable personal first-person films. And I think having seen the works of both of those people inspired me to rethink how documentary could be done. Not that it's the only way to make documentaries, but it's certainly a way that I felt much more comfortable with, because suddenly I was able to film the world around me with curiosity and with a certain degree of passion, but I was also both figuratively and literally putting myself, my own story, in front of the camera, and it wasn't a matter of just expecting other people to do it. I had to do it too, and that appealed to me, to sort of include myself in what I expected other people to do in front of the camera.
Was that first film Sherman's March, or was there was one?
There was a
that?
Short film before that called Backyard.
Was it in festivals? Was it in the festivals? And I mean,
oh, very
people
limited.
See it?
It's a 40-minute film, so it was harder to get out. But it was where I worked out some of my ideas for the voiceover narration that I write, and for my own appearances on camera, in front of the camera, and then utilizing highly personal family footage
it's
to
sort
explore
of a,
larger themes.
Right, of course. It was almost, it's like home movies on steroids or something.
Yes.
And your voice, your style, of course, was also something you, nobody was narrating films like that. You had the band with that, you
notorious
know,
voice.
Every once in a while.
The voice of God, we call it. I can do that too.
Yeah. And I'm certain early on people had to say, what are you doing? I mean, you can't talk like that in your films. And
tremendous difficulty raising money for this film initially.
Right.
Nobody wanted to fund it. Right. And, you know, I had shot enough of it where you could get an idea as to how it would work. Mm-hmm. And I got turned down by 10 foundations, many of which were in the South, which is where I thought I could definitely raise money. Mm-hmm. Arts foundations and public television outlets, and WGBH in Boston finally gambled a little bit of money on it, thinking this might be an interesting experiment. So, and then from then on, it was fine.
But and that's when you moved to Boston.
Pardon me?
And that's when you moved from South to Boston.
No, I was already living there.
You realize, go where the money is.
That's right.
You're already living there. What do you make of documentaries? And you know, where they've come to at this point, where sort of, because they have not only become sort of mainstream entertainment and categories, and now they're actually even, there's a conversation about whether or not there should be a new category in the Academy Awards for foreign documentaries, which, who would have thought?
For which?
Ago. Foreign language documentaries. Yeah, well, it's a conversation that's going on in the film community right now. Whether it's happening with the Academy, I don't know, but it's... there is a movement to sort of make that a new category.
Well, I mean, talk about great differences over the last 30 years. When I began shooting, to want to be a documentary filmmaker was an obscure profession. What do you mean? You mean, especially if you didn't want to make history documentaries, nature documentaries, or biography docs. And this is the thing my father was so perplexed by. Why are you filming us sitting at the dining room table? Who cares about this? Will this be useful? And, you know, one of those scenes is in Sherman's March where my father's asking me that. How is this useful for anything? And yet, not only have personal documentaries, or I actually hate that phrase, it's like personal deodorant. What does it mean? You know, it's just this quasi-lukewarm. But that's what they're being called these days, personal documentaries.
You object to that because you feel like it takes that universal theme that you touched on out of the conversation, if they're just calling it, if it's categorized as a personal documentary.
I just don't like the phrase. It just somebody's got to come up with a better genre.
I see.
It's not a bad phrase. I'm being humorous about it. But not only has it's become possible to make these films and actually have them draw interest in audiences and sell DVDs and tickets and... the whole notion of making documentary features has become recognized and legitimate in the eyes of the world as something that you can do and make a living at and have people respond to. I mean, the number of documentary features that are in theaters available on DVD now is just staggering.
Are there any that caught your attention?
I've been on juries, you know, for film festivals, and I was in Korea, in Seoul, just 2 months ago, and saw a new crop of new films, and there were remarkable films. There's a Czech film called Private Universe that I thought was just stunning, and we gave a prize to. And then Steve Malin, who's a young American documentary maker, made a film called High Tech, Low Tech, which I thought was quite wonderful. So there are always these... Steve's someone whose work I didn't know. I think he's quite young, maybe even his first film. I don't know. But new films are coming up all the time. So you find them in festivals, and they make their way into DVDs and into various venues like the IFC Center, which is where my film's going to be shown, which is doing a
great...
which is doing a great job of getting independently produced work into the public, making it available to the public. So, you know, that's an example of two documentaries, for instance, that I've seen fairly recently. I knew nothing about the filmmakers, and I thought they were both terrific.
Have you seen The Waiting Room yet?
I have not. I've heard it's quite good, but have not.
Pete Nix is the...
And to be a little more conventional, you know, I greatly respect the work of Errol Morris, for instance. And Fred Wiseman is a touchstone for my entire generation. He's amazing, and he keeps generating films, you know, like one a year.
It's mind-boggling, he's still coming out with, as you said, a movie a year practically.
Right.
And he still rather has an appetite for telling these stories, or letting the stories be told.
Right.
Oh, and last night I was at this DCTV that had an anniversary. I don't know if you know about this.
Which? Sorry?
DCTV, they've been programming documentaries, and they're going to build a new theater dedicated to just documentaries downtown.
Oh. Okay.
Shocking, but true. Anyway, just chatting with Al Maisels last night.
Yes. And, he's ubiquitous. He's everywhere.
He does. He'll show up at an opening of an envelope, as they say.
I've given Al... awards at three different festivals.
You know, the same night.
Same guy.
Same guy, same night, actually.
No, well, not that, but it's funny.
Yeah.
I just keep getting phone calls. Do you mind presenting Al Maisels with his career award at our film festival? It's become a kind of joke for me at this point.
Yeah, I don't know how he does it. So did you feel during the filming of Photographic Memory that when you found the subjects, when you had your reunion, that things were clicking and that you knew you had something special?
Oh,
I mean, do you worry about that? Or you just have a confidence at this point that you know you're onto something?
Well, I guess you broaden your expectations a bit. To me, say if I were to find the woman I had been looking for in Photographic Memory, I conditioned myself to be prepared to include whatever it was I found and not to categorically eliminate anything that didn't fulfill my expectations as to what she was like. And so I think if you, as a documentary filmmaker, you sign a covenant to sort of take life as it comes to you, and in fact surprises generate more interesting footage, that's just part of the bargain. And I didn't know what I'd find. I didn't know if I'd even find her.
Right.
And so, but the tension of that narrative of whether or not you're going to find the person you're looking for or the place, or depends on what the situation is, but I think drives you as a filmmaker, and also that energy transfers itself to the film itself if you are clever enough in how you manipulate the footage in the editing room.
Has Maud seen the film?
She's seen a DVD of it, but she hasn't seen the film.
Okay. Yeah. And obviously Adrian
seen it
approves.
Many times.
Yeah. Approves, because he's touring with you to some degree. Ross, thank you so much. The name of the film, again, is Photographic Memory. It's playing at the IFC Center here in New York and other theaters and cities around the country. And the filmmaker is Ross McElwee. And I'm so glad you submitted to the FilmWax radio interview. You're not even perspiring.
Well, I feel very comfortable. You're a very, very good host. Thank you, Adam.
Oh, thank you.